Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 66 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, November 26, 2021. Joining us in the Art House is Dr. Krista Heiser with another installment of the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. Krista will share insights she gleaned from reading Dina Metzger's novel A Rain of Nightbirds and from speaking with the author. We also have a good news report. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz from Yale Climate Connections tells us about a disaster resiliency program for Spanish-speaking residents in Sonoma County, California. But first, we take a deep dive into the topic of hospitality. Living in a world with stronger and more frequent extreme weather events, giving and receiving hospitality, well, it's becoming the new normal for humans.
We often don't welcome people, or we don't welcome what's happening in this world around us because we think we don't have enough. I'm not sure that that's a helpful starting place.
That's Jamie R. Reeves, an American public theologian in the UK.
And at the moment, split my time between freelance work and then at Sarum College based in Salisbury as the coordinator for the Center for Encountering the Bible. My work is intersection between theology and public issues. I tend to narrow those things down to religion and conflict or conflict and peace. Gender, as a woman and working in the Bible, gender is a pretty easy thing to do and needs to be done. And then hospitality and memory, collective memory usually, because that then fuels conflict or peacemaking, and it's connected in that way.
In June 2019, at the Wild Goose Festival in North Carolina, with enthusiastic crowds cheering nearby, I met with Jamie. Now, some people hear the word hospitality, and they imagine putting out cookies for guests.
Yeah, tea and biscuits in the UK, sweet tea and good barbecue or something like that in the American South, which is where I'm originally from. It's not about being nice. It might be about being kind, but sometimes the kind thing is the telling the truth. And so the relationship between hospitality and truth, I think, is really important, really useful and necessary. Maybe the most useful link is around the myth of scarcity versus abundance. We have operated in the world being oriented toward an ethic of scarcity. There's just not enough to go around. And a lot of our climate change conversation is there's not enough to go around too, right?
Jamie will share with us some of the theories she considers as she researches, writes, and speaks about hospitality. Adding to this discussion, I also chatted with Dr. Natasha DeJarnett.
I'm an assistant professor of environmental medicine in the Christina Lee Brown Environ Institute at the University of Louisville, where I'm building a research portfolio on the effects of extreme heat on cardiovascular disease.
She is also a professorial lecturer at the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health. She serves on four different boards, including serving as the chair of the governing board of Citizens Climate Education. Dr. DeJarnett is our most frequent guest on Citizens Climate Radio, and for an important reason. As a public health expert, she reveals for us the many risks of extreme weather.
For me, hearing all of the negative and uncovering, you know, all of the negative ways that things can impact health, for me, that inspires me. That makes me say, there's a place for me to fit in because it does this, this, and that, and that, and that, and that. But that can be very overwhelming for people. So I appreciate that you focus on solutions and what we can do.
All right, let's hear about these dangers that are upon us, and then the ways that we can promote hospitality, empathy, and policies that protect lives and improve public health.
We have increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and this is increasing surface water temperatures because heat is being trapped below. These increased surface water temperatures are making the occurrence and severity of extreme weather events more frequent and more extreme. we look back over recent years, 2017 was a record-breaking year for hurricanes here, with Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria all making landfall in the U.S. and all happening within a very narrow time frame. And then insert 2020. There were more named storms to make landfall on the U.S. than ever. We even reached well into the Greek alphabet for storm naming. So what you're sharing is so important in terms of hospitality, because we're seeing that there is an increased need for hospitality when it comes to these extreme weather events and people becoming displaced. And there's quite a bit of displacement. If we look on a global level, on average, 20 million people are displaced and have to move to other countries this year due to climate change. If we just look at the extreme heat aspects of climate change, research estimates that 1 billion or more will be displaced within the next 50 years. In 2018, 16 million people were displaced by global weather-related disasters, and the estimates are that 1.2 million of those were Americans. And then going back even further, we've been seeing these trends for quite some time. In 2014, over 19 million people around the world were forced to be displaced due to natural disasters. And this is according to the Norwegian Refugee Council. And then they also go on to report that people today are 60% more likely to be displaced by a weather-related disaster compared to the 1970s.
Because of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, researchers have a lot of information about how that megastorm displaced people.
1.5 million evacuated before Hurricane Katrina. There were 150,000 to 200,000 that remained. The data suggests that up to 6,000 households were still displaced a month after Hurricane Katrina, and that shelters at that time were housing 273,000 people. One thing we do know is that the earlier and further that we can evacuate from a storm, the better our mental health outcomes are after a storm. But the storms are extremely stressful. There's illness, there's injury, as I pointed out. Storms increase our risk of depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress. There's also other stressors that add to it in the aftermath. There's job loss, there's home destruction, there's even the loss of family and friends. But there's also this disrupted social cohesion where we have this connectedness with our community and we may be uprooted into a new community. For some people, this can impact health through a diminished sense of self.
And it's not only storms like Katrina, Irma, and Maria that are displacing people. Sea level rise has forced communities to relocate.
Sea level rise projections at a lower risk scenario of 0.9 meters of sea level rise puts 4.2 million at risk. And at the higher level of 1.8 meters, this could leave 13.1 million affected here in the U.S. We also have wildfires. The November 2018 Woolsey wildfires displaced an estimated 182,000 in California. The combined wildfires of 2019 displaced 100,000 people.
Extreme heat, a topic we covered last episode, also disrupts lives.
From this summer, and we know this has been a unique summer in terms of extreme heat. We had a heat dome that affected the Pacific Northwest. We also had heat advisories along the East Coast near the same time. This was actually reported to be the hottest summer on record. 195 million of 300 million Americans faced dangerously high temperatures in the mainland U.S., and there were under excessive heat advisories during this time.
Using hospitality to respond to the threats of extreme heat is becoming a common practice in communities. Churches, community centers, and volunteer groups can play a role.
cooling centers are places where people can go and cool off on a hot day. Often these are public spaces like libraries or maybe even a mall where people may be able to go and find some refuge on a hot day. I feel that this is also an opportunity for churches to be able to open their doors and offer places for people to cool off on a hot day. It can be life-saving. In the absence of being able to be in person in some areas where it's, you know, just not safe at the moment, there's often education that can be offered to protect people that just may not be quite aware that we are in certain situations, like an extreme heat event, or that there is a threat of a situation coming. I think that churches can help shore up that with education to their congregants, as well as informing them and even maybe building support systems. In New York City, there's a program that's called Be a Buddy. And Be a Buddy helps to ensure that older adults who are often more socially isolated receive information that they need when there is a threat of extreme weather, extreme heat, something of that nature, ensuring that someone reaches out to them. So they have a buddy that reaches out to them and makes sure that they know. And I can certainly see churches having many opportunities to do something like that, and the connections are already established between many members together.
Jamie Reeves shares examples of ways congregations are responding. For instance, to address the myth of scarcity, she tells the story of a church service in New York City. Through the Eucharist, or the communion service, sharing bread and wine, the congregation learned an important lesson.
There was probably 100 people in the worship service, and they did Eucharist with one slice of white bread, and that was all that was there. And they took the smallest amount, but enough to have Eucharist, and that one slice served the entire congregation. There is enough here. You don't need to be taking the half the whole freaking loaf. There's enough here for us if we pay attention to what everybody else needs.
In a famous story of Jesus feeding 5,000 men plus women and children, they started with just two loaves and a few fishes. Feeding all these people, many interpret it as Jesus miraculously multiplying the food through special powers. Jamie offers another interpretation, though, a miracle of sharing.
People had food on them. They just weren't going to pull it out in front of everybody else at the time. And so once he oriented them towards sharing, they were like, oh, well, yeah, actually, I've got this in my bag, too. You know, and like, and there ended up being enough for everybody because they had it all squirreled away for themselves.
In a time of growing displacement, Jamie points to examples of extreme hospitality.
The specific work that I do is around what I call protective hospitality. And so that's the provision of sanctuary or refuge to the threatened other, often at risk of the host. I guess technically protective hospitality would be a homeless shelter sort of situation, in the sense of you're creating safe space for someone to come and live and sleep. But there's an element of risk to the host that I think we often don't really spend a lot of time thinking about, and that keeps people from practicing that work because obviously the risk is involved. Within the work that I do around hospitality, and I do interfaith work, so Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and how those three traditions formed their theology and their ethic of hospitality around this is what God has called us to do. The ultimate thing is being around love of neighbor, around protecting the ones who are marginalized, the ones who have been abused and neglected, the stranger, the widow, the orphan. And within the Hebrew Bible, the 26 lines of do this because you were once strangers in Egypt, you know how it feels, this is what you need to do.
To do this type of work, Jamie suggests we need to shift our thinking and our default response.
In order to practice hospitality, you need to be oriented toward what Philip Halley, who's a Christian ethicist, called a yay-saying ethic versus a nay-saying ethic. So what he was doing, he researched communities who put themselves at risk for others during the Second World War, traditionally called rescuers during the Holocaust, folks who hid or helped Jews escape and political prisoners. And there was a different orientation for communities who did that work as opposed to those who didn't. So what was it about Christian communities who put themselves at risk for others versus the ones who supported the regime. He said it was a yay-saying versus a nay-saying ethic. And so yay-saying ethic, he would say, is a default yes toward the other, as opposed to a no. So it's a default abundant ethic. We have enough, we will help you. An ethic that is oriented towards dignity, preservation of life, wholeness, well-being. It is resistant to the status quo, and it requires action. And the other thing that I think is really interesting, particularly in sort of biblical studies work, is he says it's less hygienic, quoting that. And so when we kind of talk about action and ideology, we're talking about purity in a lot of ways. And like, we don't want to get tainted by, you know, being with folks who are different. And he was saying that those who are practicing hospitality are going to get dirty, and they're open to getting dirty because they know that that is the higher calling, is to preserve life and dignity and saying yes and being oriented toward the other.
Jamie flips the script by using negative terms to describe life-saving practices.
I also talk about hospitality as contagion. We use dirty and tainted as a negative term, but in this way, it's kind of when you experience it and it's meaningful for you, that you then go tell other people. It becomes viral. It's this experience of being able to be changed. And that tainting is the changing, the dirtiness of it, that God has called us to get our hands dirty, to get involved, to not sit on the sidelines and stay clean.
In pursuing solutions and promoting hospitality, Dr. DeJarnett stresses that we look deeply and how extreme weather affects us all, but differently.
For the communities that are at greatest threat to climate events, the Prevention Institute lists the following policies, practices, and procedures that have produced inequities in the built environment that may leave certain populations more susceptible. That includes segregation, and thereby redlining, the interstate highway system, divestment from the urban core, investment in suburban areas, the siting of hazardous land use, and then also the foreclosure crisis. Understanding the root of barriers that we have to equity, I think that is important that we think around that framing when we discuss and identify solutions, understanding that there are those challenges.
Some of the solutions incorporate the natural world into our cities and towns. They include transforming neighborhoods so they're cooler and therefore more hospitable.
Green infrastructure can help manage floods, can help absorb rainfall, can prevent water from overflowing our wastewater systems and our roadways and our homes. The green infrastructure can help manage these situations. For example, rain gardens. For example, using permeable pavements that can absorb water. Green cover plants to replace non-absorbent land cover like concrete.
Dr. DeJarnett is part of a research initiative to build green infrastructure and community while improving public health.
We have the Green Heart Initiative at University of Louisville, and it's a partnership between University of Louisville, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, the Nature Conservancy, and several additional organizations. I like to say that we are planting trees for healthier air, but we're actually planting more than trees. We're planting shrubs. We're increasing residential greenness. This is a randomized controlled trial where trees are the intervention. We are looking at health and air quality before planting the trees. So that's been taking place this summer. And then we will continue to assess health and air quality after planting the trees. Because we're a research institution, we're certainly very connected with understanding the health impacts. So we're able to do this as a randomized controlled trial with nature being the intervention. I've recently been awarded a diversity supplement through the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to assess health disparities within the Green Heart population, but also add in air temperature monitoring to this initiative. And air temperature is such an important part of understanding air quality. So we expect that temperatures may be lowered where the tree planting is increased, And then we also are going to further investigate the toxic stress linked with health disparities, namely discrimination, to see if the toxic stress of discrimination may modify the relationship that we know exists between air pollution exposures and cardiovascular outcomes. So how perceptions of discrimination may affect that risk.
As I listen to public theologian Jamie R. Reeves and public health expert Dr. Natasha DeJarnett, I have a clearer picture of hospitality in a climate-changed world. For me, that means being aware of the diverse needs that exist in my community and being available to help in a crisis. That might also mean providing financial support or time volunteering at emergency shelters, food pantries, and cooling centers. It's about pursuing creative solutions that build community and create spaces for people to find refuge for both short and long periods of displacement. It's about seeing a need and being willing to disrupt my own life, my own plans, even my own home. Maybe this conversation challenges you to be more engaged in your own community. As the impacts of climate change increase, so will the need for hospitality, resilience, and community building. One resource you can look at is the U.S. Climate Resilience Toolkit. You can find it at toolkit.climate.gov. That's toolkit.climate.gov. And to learn about how you can start or join a climate resilience hub, visit climatecrew.org. That website again, climatecrew.org. I will have these resources and more in our show notes. Just visit our blog at citizensclimatelobby.org. Now it is time for the Art House. Krista Heiser is back with her semi-regular feature to our program, The Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. Krista's audio essays get to the heart of what many of us are thinking, feeling, and wondering about the world we are co-creating. In each installment of The Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club, Krista shows us the important role literature has for humans in a climate change world.
This month, the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club met with author Dina Metzger to talk about her 2017 novel, A Rain of Night Birds. It includes a plot twist about the 2007 IPCC report, which was the first to include mention of traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK, what we now call indigenous knowledge. Dina said, "Fiction has the possibility of introducing an entirely different way of knowing." She said, "The book isn't really about TEK. It's about what the experience is of really knowing something." She said, "In the course of writing it, I came to know differently. What fiction can give us is an entirely different way of holding the consciousness that information provides." Wow. Dina challenged us to think about a Hippocratic oath for literature and for our lives. She said, "What would happen if we all agreed that no matter what, first, we did no harm? How we live our daily life, how we take care of each other, what we do because we have to earn a living? Imagine, first, do no harm." Now, the main character in the novel is Sandra Birdswell. She's a white woman who does her PhD dissertation on TEK, and she holds a unique perspective that is sometimes called two-eyed seeing, or feeling. We first meet Sandra during the somatic experience of a solar flare. Dina describes this moment in the novel. She said what was so particular about Sandra Birdswell is that she was not only a scientist trained in that way, but she could also feel in an entire way what all of it meant. The book opens with her knowing in her body-spirit mind, she knows there's a solar flare occurring. Now that's information in science, but it was feeling it and knowing it that was the information to her. Another character in the book is Sandra's father, John Birdswell. He's a real country doc, according to Dina, who said, "John went to the reservation instead of the Vietnam War. There he learned what indigenous medicine is and what it means to be a medicine man. He begins to understand that place where Western medicine just doesn't do what it's called to do. What becomes central for him is very basic, or used to be basic, Dina says, about Western medicine. The Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. So Dina wondered, what would a literature look like that did no harm, that did not lead directly to extinction? She calls this work the literature of restoration. She said, literature would recognize the ongoing primary context of the earth and all the beings. She said, if that isn't our ground, then we're creating literature that's based on technology and what we humans have created. And that's what has taken us where we are. It's not only the content, but the form. She gave us some advice. She said, look for books of fiction that represent very, very deep knowing. Look for books of fiction that represent very, very deep knowing. So that we can enter, all of us, into the knowing that can be so much deeper than information, data, statistics. The reality is, she said, that A Reign of Nightbirds came to me, as many of my books have. I can't pretend I really understand it, but I know that is true, that a different level of knowing comes through me in the writing. What if reading fiction, the reader is able to soften their right and left brain and thus experience a different way of knowing? What if, rather than being about TEK as an object of intellectual inquiry, the reader is able to really get into the worldview of this indigenous epistemology? In reading the book, we experience the difference between Western ways of seeing things and indigenous ways of seeing. We begin to learn what has happened in this great divide and how we might bring it together.
That was Krista Heiser with the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. You can see a written version of this essay at medium.com. Just look for the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club for Sustainability in Higher Education. I will have links in our show notes for you. And if you want to suggest a Cli-Fi book for Krista, email radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Our good news story this month fits in so well with the theme of hospitality.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In recent years, residents of Sonoma County, California, have suffered the impacts of multiple dangerous wildfires.
Either people losing power, people having to completely evacuate from where they live, people losing food because of power outages, people losing work.
Amanda Hernandez is with Corazon Healdsburg, a nonprofit that serves Latinos and others in the local community. As the climate warms, wildfires are becoming more frequent and severe. So Corazon Healdsburg is helping people prepare. The group offers a disaster resiliency program for Spanish-speaking residents. It teaches them how to sign up for emergency alerts, create an evacuation plan, and pack an emergency go bag. Participants learn to prepare financially, too. For example, by buying renter's insurance and creating a budget so they can save for an emergency. Those who complete the program receive a year of paid renter's insurance, plus a backpack full of supplies like masks, portable radios, and chargers.
So it's a really great way to take all the different things that we've talked about through the program and incentivize the community member to then take action and to be prepared in their own lives.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org. Thank you for joining me for episode 66 of Citizens Climate Radio. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Montorano, Flannery Winchester, Kitty Zarkreski, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. The music on today's show comes from epidemicsound.com. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see our show notes and find links to our guests. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.